Chapter 26, Turning It Around, a Thought Experiment. The first paragraph of this chapter says, King for a Day thought experiments are challenging, rewarding, and dangerous. The challenge is that it can be difficult to think through any situation with all the current variables removed. Such experiments are rewarding because if they are conducted with an appropriate level of sobriety, they can be a tremendous help in clarifying vision. What would you do if everyone let you? Is actually the same question as what are you actually trying to accomplish? And interrupt here, that question, what are you actually trying to accomplish, is the central question that you need to be able to ask and answer yourself in any endeavor like this. What is it? Before you spend a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears trying to do something, it'd be a good idea to have an idea of what it is you're trying to do. So, such thought experiments are dangerous because they require that we postulate a frictionless world, which is not the world we live in. Thus, it is all too easy to drift off into utopian speculations. It's great to define what it is you're trying to do, but if you try to accomplish it all in a frictionless world, that is little other than daydreaming. You're daydreaming. If you are stuck in this world and you don't attempt anything unless everybody else in the world gives you permission, then you're not going to accomplish anything either. So, too easy to drift off into utopian speculations. And having just escaped from the 20th century, who needs those anymore? So, I want to present here a suggested list of reforms to a hypothetical school. Okay, our hypothetical situation is this: suppose we're dealing with a fairly large Christian school, 500 students or so, K through 12. The board has decided that they are adrift and lacking in vision. The parents are in complete agreement with this assessment without one dissenting voice. They have asked me to present a series of reforms to them, and what I say they will do. Like I said, a frictionless world. Moreover, I have good reason to believe that they're actually going to do it. The student council at their last gathering decided that everyone is tired of sneakers and blue jeans and that 15 minutes of homework a night is too little. Students want to change too. And in addition, mirabile dictu, all the reforms I have in mind do not violate any existing federal or state laws or UN declarations on human rights. So in that world, what would I propose that a school like this do? The first thing, the first issue would be the foundational issues. The school needs to acquire a confessional identity. Pop evangelical sentiments diffused in their normal gaseous way are utterly inadequate for resisting the spirit of our age, which wants to seep into the unsuspecting school through every available crack. Put another way, a generic, soft, porous evangelical identity is porous enough for the world to get into. And the zeitgeist, the modern assumptions, the postmodern assumptions, the homosexual assumptions, the statist assumptions are all going to seep into a school that doesn't have a decided, pronounced Christian commitment. And it's got to be more than a generic Christian commitment. I would much prefer to send my kids or see my grandkids in a confessional Lutheran school, for example, where all the teachers, the entire board, everybody was a decided Lutheran, despite my disagreements with Lutheranism, then I would want to have my kids or grandkids attending a school where everybody more or less agreed with me, more or less, kind of, because they didn't actually think anything. They didn't think anything in particular. G.K. Chesterton once said, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And I think it is really important for a school to stand for something, to say, we are evangelicals, here's our evangelical statement of faith, or we're Reformed, this is the way, here's the Westminster Confession, or this is a Lutheran school. I would like to see schools run by people who wake up in the morning knowing what they believe. knowing what they think, knowing where they are. So a school should have all the foundational confessional issues settled. Now, of course, in my ideal scenario, they would come down on a confessional identity that I believe is more scripturally based. I'm Reformed and Presbyterian, and I believe that. So if you said, oh, so which one do you think you know, I'm in Baskin-Robbins, and I really like the chocolate, and you ask me what flavor, yada, I'm gonna tell you chocolate. So that's the foundational issues. The second foundational task would be to make a genuine countercultural statement in the transformed appearance of the student body. The students would all be required to wear uniforms or define school clothing, and all forms of cultural outlandishness would be banished from the premises. A lot of worldview is communicated through uniforms. The modern world likes to pretend that they don't have uniforms, but they do. Ripped jeans that you paid $50 extra for, that's a uniform. You're making a statement. I would want the school to have a distinct cultural presence in town. When everybody glances, there's a kid from Logos School. There's a kid from your school. So that's the second thing. The third thing, and I want to emphasize this, I'm going to read you what I wrote in this book, and then I'm going to adjust it a little bit. What I wrote was, third, I would raise tuition so that at least 85% of the cost of the education was paid by the parents. The remainder would be covered by the school's very capable development office. Now, I'd want to italicize the words there, at least. In the years since I wrote this, Logos School has moved from the goal of 85% of our budgetary costs covered by parents to a model of 100% of our budgetary costs covered by parents. So imagine, think of it this way. The education that is being delivered day-to-day at your school is an education that costs a certain fixed amount in the market. That education is worth something objective. And that cost is going to be covered in a Christian school from three sources. One will be the parents, one will be donors, and the other will be sacrifices on the part of the staff. Taking lower wages because I want to teach English in a classical Christian school, and so I'll take a smaller amount, lesser amount than I otherwise think I deserve because I'm so dedicated to this. That's simply a donation to the school in kind. So, a Christian school, a private Christian school, is floated by tuition, by donors, grandparents writing a check, or you know, some friend of the school writes a check. And then the third would be sacrifices on the part of staff. We used to run at a level where we wanted 85% of all the budgetary costs to be covered by parents through tuition. And we have now moved to 100% of the costs of the education within a budgeted school year is covered by tuition only. That enables you to not take so much from the teachers. You can pay the teachers a better amount. And it also means that your donors are not giving to fill up a hole. So if you have if your budget is for, let's say, a budget of a school, of a Christian school is $500,000 for the school year, and you're coming in at $450,000 realized, and you need $50,000 to make budget. That means that whoever comes up with that $50,000 is shoveling dirt into a hole. Okay. Now, donors generally would much prefer to have their donations go to build something positive. So the way we have it configured now is the cost of the education is borne by the parents paying tuition and the teachers making some sacrifice, but not as much as they used to. And then donors are big donations that come in are for your capital improvements, capital campaigns. It's not part of your annual budget. It's not going toward payroll or books or curriculum or the costs of education. It's going, it would go to the new gym or to the new lunchroom or some off-budget expenses. The fourth thing that I would want to do is I'd want to keep the school free of all governmental entanglements. Tax support for education is not inherently wrong. In fact, it might be defensible if our government were openly Christian, but it isn't, and consequently, private Christian schools should stay completely free, entirely free of taking any state money. So then I would turn to the curriculum. The structure I would propose is the medieval trivium, grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, which we covered earlier in the book. And then as children grow through the stages of child development, the first stage, grammar, corresponds to the Paul Parent stage, then the Pert stage corresponds to dialectic, and then the poetic stage corresponds to rhetoric. So now this... that's the structure of the trivium. That's the skeletal structure of the trivium. I would want more fat on those bones, much more than what is available in many of our traditional course offerings. As such additions are considered, we run into the old how many hours we have in the day problem, but there's nothing that can't be dealt with in principle. So I'd start teaching Latin in the third grade. I would require that all students acquire, as a matter of principle, musical literacy. You want all your graduates to be able to sight read music, to know the basics of musical practice and theory. I would want a minimum of a half an hour of musical instruction a day, and that instruction would include sight reading, choral participation, and working with basic instruments like a recorder or a keyboard, that sort of thing. In the older grades, I would want the subjects to be integrated as much as possible. If they take classical literature, for example, the same year that they're taking ancient history and Old Testament survey, because a lot of those things happened in the same world. When Homer wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey, there were prophets in Israel running around just a few hundreds of miles away. So that they were all operating in the same context, and you want your students to acquire that context. I would say in the younger grades, I would want to make sure that you teach language phonetically. English is a phonetic language, and we ought not to be teaching any kind of whole language or look-say or lazy, you know, those sort of lazy, quote-unquote, holistic approaches. You want students to learn what sounds the letters make, even though English has got some weird exceptions, oddball exceptions. It's still at its heart a phonetic language, and if you provide that phonetic literacy, the younger students are being given a key that can unlock virtually any book in the library. So that's an overview. That's what I would do with a school that wanted to turn it around.